Hello and welcome to The Learning College. I'm Alex Linder, and you can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com. Today we're going to resume with Revelo P. Oliver, and he has a very interesting article on Haiti, and the article is called Racial Democracy. So it's all about, I guess it was a big thing back then in the 60s, and he's going to tell us what he thinks. So let's dig into it. Racial democracy. In 1963, this is in brackets, prefatory material. In 1963, American newspapers devoted much of their drivel to propaganda about the island of Hispaniola. The purpose was to stimulate the Christians' inveterate itch to meddle in other people's business, and the Americans' more recent delusion that they are a people chosen, capital PC, to make the world safe for democracy, in quotes, and unsafe for civilized men. I thought it worthwhile, therefore, to place in the July, August, and September issues, those are two issues, a two-part article describing the actual state of affairs in both Haiti and Santo Domingo, entitled The Black and the Red, with, of course, a punning allusion to Stendhal, his novel, The Black and the Red, French writer Stendhal. The first of these is reprinted here. Haiti. Haiti, which has an area a little larger than that of Vermont and is about as mountainous, occupies a third of the island of Hispaniola that was ceded to France by Spain at the close of the War of the Grand Alliance in 1697. It was a prosperous and flourishing colony of plantations, operated with slaves imported from various parts of Africa, until 1791, when some slaves attending a voodoo orgy thought of butchering their masters. The idea aroused enthusiasm that spread to some other plantations and initiated a series of disorders, chiefly stealthy nocturnal assaults on isolated homes, which the colonists were unable to suppress because they were at first confused by a series of unusually injudicious and always conflicting orders from the various revolutionary governments in France, and then they had to fight off a British invasion. So, the slaves are revolting, and France has undergone a revolution and talked stupidly and floridly about the rights of man, and the slaves are, well, I'd be a man, taking that to heart. In 1802, a black who first called himself Dessalines, Dessalines, and later Emperor Jacques, gained control with help from the British, who regarded him as an ally against the French. In 1804, 2 years later, with the approval of his secret backers and advisors, the British Abolition Society, he proclaimed a new era of civil rights, including extermination of the whites. All white men, women, and children in the territory were systematically butchered, many of them with tortures that showed no little ingenuity, and some of them were eaten. So cannibalism and mass extermination, mass slaughter of all whites of every race and of every age and station, backed by the British Abolition Society. It is said that a number of white women were secretly spared and kept in pens for future fun. That is doubtless true, but the story commonly told in Haiti that accounts for the presence of a minority of mulattoes in a population that is otherwise entirely Negro is false. Free mulattoes formed about 10% of the population before the revolt began, and, as a matter of fact, Emperor Jacques, having discovered that the existence of mulattoes was incompatible with true equality, had made preparations to exterminate them also when he was bushwhacked in 1806 by one of his generals. So the usual black action. After an interlude of anarchy, Haiti came under the rule of a freeborn Negro of great vision and talent called Christophe, who proclaimed himself Emperor Henry and gave the territory the most stable and efficient native government that it has ever had. He is still celebrated for the ruses and hoaxes with which he baffled, bluffed, and blackmailed the British. The ruins of his great palace, Sans Souci, are an enduring monument to his genius. He was determined to civilize Haiti, and he maintained order with a strong hand, often whacking off with his own cutlass the head of an unruly or dilatory subject. He revived agriculture and trade, and even succeeded in making his subjects work. That he was a man of foresight is shown by the fact that he always carried with him the bullet of solid silver that he fired into his brain when the time came in 1820. Since then, Haiti has been ruled by a succession of presidents, generals, dictators, emperors, and the like, so that they would have a chance to sprint for a ship in the harbor when the winds of change began to blow. Executives leaving office in this way may also head for a foreign embassy, but when President Sam made it to the French legation in 1915, his constituents simply followed him in, tied a rope about him, and spent the rest of the day dragging his body through the streets of Port-au-Prince until he was literally worn out. The people today. Most of the plantations that made Haiti so prosperous under the French have, of course, long since reverted to jungle, but enough food is raised, chiefly in small clearings, to feed the population. In addition, considerable quantities of coffee, sisal, that's some kind of rope plant, sugar and cacao, that's the chocolate bean plant, sisal, I may be mispronouncing, are grown mostly on larger farms for export. So they grow coffee, sisal, sugar, and cacao beans for export. The official language is French, which is spoken fluently by a small minority of the population and understood to some extent by about two-thirds of it. Most of the people communicate in the dialects called Creole, which are grotesque mixtures of various African languages with French and some English and with a little Spanish thrown in for good measure. According to the best estimates, the population consists of about 3,500,000 Negroes and about 158,000 mulattoes. The latter include most of the educated class and so dominate the professions, business, and commission part of the army. Most of the mulattoes are educated, and some of them are very well educated indeed, traditionally in France. Through them, Haiti has produced a respectable quantity of good French verse and prose. For a good conspectus, see Louis Maurepos, Anthologie d'un siècle de poésie haïtienne, Anthology of a Century of Haitian Poetry, Paris, 1925, which contains some admirable lyrics. There is a tradition of culture and refinement, although, for reasons to be mentioned shortly, it is now declining. The cultivated mulattoes are sometimes called aristocrats, which is true in the sense that they regard themselves as superior, are, unlike the majority of the population, born in wedlock, and can often proudly trace their ancestry to a French colonist. They must not be confused with the nobility that Haiti has employed from time to time in the past, e.g. under the rule of Emperor Faustin I, who created hundreds of black dukes, barons, counts, and knights to adorn his court, including the holders of such distinguished and memorable titles as the Duke of Lemonade, the Duke of Marmalade, and the Duke of Castor Oil. Such nobility, it is needless to say, vanished when its royal or imperial master found it expedient to scram. The great majority of the Negroes in Haiti are illiterate and intend to stay that way. A team of high-powered educational experts was rushed in by the United Nations in 1947, spent $500,000 of your money, and claimed that it had succeeded in teaching 50 persons to read a little. Haiti now has a small resident white population, as distinct from foreign diplomats and commercial representatives, of about 3,000 persons, mostly traders, moneylenders, and the like, and principally of Levantine origin, i.e. Jews. These are cordially hated by both Negroes and mulattoes, and thus provide the one issue on which the two groups can agree. The racial problem. Since the time of Dessalines, there has been a strong and ever-increasing tension between the Negroes and the mulattoes in Haiti. And for almost a century, this racial antagonism has been a bitter and on occasion ferocious hatred for which there was almost no parallel in the world until the American liberals of our own day got down to work in Africa. Some Negroes in Haiti now blame Dessalines, who is usually regarded as the national hero, for not having exterminated the mulattoes at the time he took care of the whites. There have been numerous attempts to remedy his oversight, but on a comparatively small scale. In 1879, President Solomon, although only partly Negro himself, felt an idealistic urge to end racial discrimination. He began the massacres very systematically, but he accomplished little before he found it necessary to concentrate his entire army of 13,000 men to reduce a group of 100 young mulattoes who, being so reactionary as to object to being butchered, equipped themselves with rifles and took refuge on a promontory. After more than 9 months of hard fighting, the Haitian army was finally victorious and killed the last of its 100 opponents, so it took 13,000 black Haitians 9 months to defeat 100 mulattoes on a high point. But it lost more than 9,000 of its best troops by rifle fire and desertion, and only with the greatest difficulty had recruits been obtained to replace those losses. The campaign had strained President Solomon's military resources to the utmost and left his army so shattered that it was unequal to further operations, so that social reform had to be postponed indefinitely. Many attempts were subsequently made, but none appears to have been on a larger scale than the incidents in 1915 in which some 200 of the leading young mulattoes of Port-au-Prince were rounded up and, if not exactly liquidated, were reduced to such a state that their remains had to be removed with shovels. Further application of the principle of majority rule was prevented by the U.S. Marines, who moved in to impose order in 1915 and remained until 1934. The United States continued official supervision of the Haiti government until 1941. Since that time, no serious incidents have occurred, but President Estime, is reported to have considered, or even planned, a massacre of mulattoes as a means of regaining his popularity shortly before he ran out of office in 1950. Although, thanks to the normal inefficiency and instability of Haitian governments, the various efforts to promote equality had numerically insignificant results, the unremitting pressures of racial animosity have been so great that the mulattoes, who as late as 1910 still formed about 10% of the population, are now reduced to about 5%. Economic necessity imposes a surface calm in normal times, but the majority and the racial minority in Haiti are forever separated by an implacable and undying hatred that will inevitably manifest itself in action whenever violence becomes feasible. Religion. Almost all of the mulattoes and many Negroes, especially in the towns and larger villages, are practicing Catholics. The total number of Christians has been variously estimated, but it is clear that they form a minority, possibly a small minority, of the population. The religion of the majority of the inhabitants of Haiti is undoubtedly represented by the voodoo cults, which are all weird conglomerations of savage superstitions and subhuman rites derived from many parts of Africa. Voodoo is certainly the strongest and possibly the only really powerful force in Haiti today. For an introduction to the complex and confusing mass of superstitions and practices, we must refer the reader to such standard works as J.J. Williams's Voodoos and Obeahs, O-B-E-A-H-S, London 1933, and Z.N. Hurston's, I assume that's Zora Neale Hurston, the famous black American writer. It was actually kind of right-wing, Voodoo Gods, 1939. And we may particularly recommend the candid work of a highly talented Haitian writer, Milo Rigaud, R-I-G-A-U-D, whose Jesus ou Legba, Jesus or Legba, L-E-G-B-A, question mark. Jesus u Legba, Paris, 1933, is disguised as a novel for reasons which will become apparent as you read it. We can offer only a few general comments. 1. You will find it impossible to understand voodoo until you realize, as many careful investigators failed to do, that you were dealing with a mentality fundamentally and generically different from your own. I wonder if Pierce really got that point from Oliver. It is a mentality to which logic is simply incomprehensible, and to which, therefore, the process of reasoning that you must use when you think are alien and meaningless. It is a consciousness that can hold, in quick succession or even simultaneously, contradictory and antithetical feelings about the same subject without perceiving the slightest conflict between those feelings. That is, it feels no need to reconcile, in line with logical consistency, any beliefs that it holds. It's non-Western, and it's non-really truly human, in a sense. The Western mind, which can understand only in terms of logical and definite relationships, automatically tries to define, classify, and systematize, and so it often defeats itself when it tries to comprehend the productions of a radically different mentality. Investigators usually begin by trying to identify the voodoo, often without realizing that they have risked misleading themselves by applying the word God to a vague supernatural entity that is both amorphous and polymorphous. It has no form and many forms, and we're trying to interpret it in terms of like our own gods. They anxiously inquire concerning the attributes of such spirits as Baron Samedi, S-A-M-E-D-I, Legba, as we mentioned, and Dambala, D-A-M-B-A-L-L-A. And they try to ascertain what functions each has, which is superior to the others, and how they are related. Since they are asking questions which are really meaningless to their informants, they naturally obtain a wide variety of answers and either try to decide which informants were lying or conclude that there are a great many different cults. Note, for example, the dismay of investigators. They're essentially anthropomorphizing these Haitians into white humans, into a different species, i.e. their own. But you have to look at Haitians for what they are, and logical consistency is not part of their religion or their culture. Note, for example, the dismay of investigators who, having correctly ascertained that Obia and Mayal are rival and mutually antagonistic forms of primitive magic, discover that the same individuals practice both. When we try to impose logic where there is none, we simply delude ourselves. 2. Believers in voodoo take toward Christianity the attitude that the white man has to his own spirits and witch doctors, who, although inferior, have some power in certain areas. When you have to deal with whites or Christian mulattoes, it is a good idea to conciliate their supernatural allies. And if you can buy or purloin some of the enemy's fetishes, such as a cross or picture of the Virgin, and put them in a voodoo shrine, that neutralizes the enemy's magic. It is, at least, a precaution that can do no harm. And so again, like Santeria, you know, mixing the voodoo and the Christian stuff. 3, voodoo rites are secret. In the backcountry, the shrines, most commonly called Hoonforts, H-O-U-N-F-O-R-T-S, are undisguised and open huts, usually equipped with at least one grotesque and obscene wooden idol. So, undisguised, open huts, equipped with at least one grotesque and obscene wooden idol, as misshapen and repulsive as the sculpture that is awarded for first prizes in our more barbaric museums of quote-unquote contemporary art. For an indication of what these idols mean to their worshippers, see the report, somewhat veiled with euphemism, in Richard A. Lederer's, L-O-E-D-E-R-E-R, Voodoo Fire, New York, 1935, pages 158 FF. In the smaller towns, the shrines are in houses, but readily identified by the designs painted on the exterior. In Port-au-Prince, the cult rooms have a status somewhat resembling that of the speakeasies during our Prohibition era. They are unmarked, but you may be sure that you are never very far from one, if you can find it. But only members of the cult are admitted to the shrines, and only rarely does a student have an opportunity for surreptitious observation of what goes on inside. 4. Communal rites normally take place out of doors at night in isolated spots to which the votaries will gladly travel long distances. Here, again, observation must be surreptitious, and the more important the rite, the greater the precautions taken to make sure that there are no outsiders in the vicinity. There is no fixed ritual, and hence the reported differences between Arada, Legba, and Petro rites, which some writers suppose to represent different cults, is largely nugatory. That means nothing. The difference, at most, is the same order as the difference between our words dance and ball as applied to social occasions. The rites are led by a male or female witch doctor, Papa Loi, Papa hyphen L-O-I, or Mama Loi, Mama Loi, Mama Loi or Papa Loi, and always involve orgiastic dances that soon induce in all the participants a state of emotional frenzy. You've probably seen that sort of thing on film. What happens next depends on the whims and the impulses of the hysterical leader and her, or less commonly his, hysterical followers. Commonly, however, as the emotions become paroxysmal, the votaries twist off the heads of chickens and, placing the necks in their mouths, suck out the blood. If goats are available, their throats are slashed open and the blood is both lapped up as a stimulating beverage and smeared over the body as a refreshing ointment. They find the corpses of these animals in the streets in South Florida where we've allowed these people to come in. The most potent rite calls for the use of a hornless goat, i.e. a human being. The eating of adults is said to have been discontinued, but it is believed that some cults, on certain very special occasions, still serve babies, either raw or stewed. Since the victims are always the children of participants in the celebration, the chances of discovery are slight, if precautions have been taken to prevent observation by outsiders. 5. We should not be supercilious about black magic. The Papa Lois and Mama Lois undoubtedly practice hypnosis and are acquainted with the use of many locally available narcotics and poisons, including cocaine from the leaves of the coca, manzanillas, manzanay apples, Royri, R-O-I-R-Y, a leguminous seed which contains cyanidic acid, and it is believed the Kingo or Kingolo, which is said to paralyze certain areas in the brain and thus produce real zombies, Guedes, G-U-E-D-E-S. We cannot really blame the followers of these witch doctors when we remember that many Europeans have been convinced that witch doctors do, in fact, possess supernatural powers and report having observed phenomena for which it is difficult to suggest a natural explanation. 6. Since you may see, even in recent weeks, some nonsense predicated on the assumption that the word voodoo, French voodoo, V-A-U-D-O-U, is derived from the Christian heresy of the Vaudois, which I don't know what that is. I note that it is simply an African term, usually written voodoo, V-U-D-U or V-O-D-U, voodoo, which means magic in various dialects of Dahomey and Senegal. So it's a legit African word. It's not a Christian. The U.S. Marines, during the 19 years in which they kept order in Haiti, sought to repress the practice of voodoo, and despite the yapping of American liberals, accomplished a great deal, not so much by breaking up celebrations as by hunting down and destroying bandits who were also Papa Lois. Papa Lois. On the best known of these, who called himself Charlemagne, see J.D. Couser, K-U-S-E-R, Haiti, Boston, 1921. Repeated demonstrations that even high-grade Uangas anointed with grease obtained by boiling human brains, did not inhibit the action of either a Springfield rifle or the Marine who was carrying it, shook the faith of some of the faithful and discouraged others. So they had like that African belief in pig grease would prevent them from being perforated by bullets. They found otherwise. Since the departure of the Marines, the voodoo cults have steadily revived. Mr. Loderer, OpSite, page 257, quotes a longtime resident of Haiti who appears to have had unique opportunities for observation and who reports that he can, quote, say with certainty that 95% of the black population are in varying degrees adherents, active or passive, of the cult. There are other estimates, some as low as 80%. The latter comes from a Christian missionary and may accordingly be affected by his hopes. Well, you know, it takes the Christians 1,000 years, so they're only 300 in, I guess. The president of Haiti is François Duvalier, who claims to be a full-blooded Negro, received some medical training in the U.S. and practiced as a physician before he went into politics. He was, what is very unusual in Haiti, chosen president in a regular election, and he was inaugurated on September 22, 1957. His predecessors in office during the 9 months preceding his election were President Paul Magloire, December 6 to 12, 1956, President Joseph Pierre-Louis, December 12, 1956 to February 3, 1957, note the shortness of tenure, President Frank Sylvain, February 7 to April 2nd, General Cantave, April 2nd to 6th, Executive Council, April 6th to 27th, General Cantave, April 27 to May 2, Reorganized Executive Council, May 2nd to 21st, Colonel Pierre Armand, May 21 to 25, President Daniel Fignole, May 26 to June 14th, General Antonio Cabreu, June 14th to September 22nd. It will be seen that the inauguration of President Duvalier greatly relieved the ambassadors stationed in Port-au-Prince, who were beginning to feel a little dizzy. Duvalier has, again, this would become Papadoc. Duvalier has remained in office ever since, a noteworthy accomplishment. His term would have expired on May 15, 1963, had he not taken the precaution of having himself re-elected in 1961 in an election in which he was the only presidential candidate. That procedure, to be sure, is regarded as unsophisticated by quote-unquote liberals in the United States, who believe that American voters should always be given a choice between Tweedledum and Tweedledee in a presidential election, since such superficial courtesies help to keep them quiet. Duvalier is by no means a despicable figure. He is said to have been both popular and competent when he practiced medicine. Like President Kennedy, he is nominally a Catholic. His real opinions are uncertain. If, as is frequently reported, he also professes and practices voodoo, it must be remembered that any shrewd politician would try to appeal to the beliefs of a large block of voters. So far as I know, no one has claimed that he emulates his fairly numerous predecessors in office who celebrated voodoo ceremonies in the presidential palace. And everyone will see that it was politically necessary for Duvalier to expel Bishop Paul Robert from Haiti in November 1962, whatever Duvalier may have felt personally about the matter. The Papalois and Mamalois of Haiti no more mind denunciations of voodoo than American communists mind denunciations of Marxism as a doctrine, but if it do anything about the practice of voodoo, they become as excited as our quote-unquote liberals at the mention of Senator McCarthy. And the bishop, instead of thundering away in his cathedral about the wickedness of voodoo, tried to incite his congregations to do something about it by interfering with voodoo rites and demanding the enforcement of certain laws that are on the books because they look good to foreigners. No president of Haiti could risk offense to more than three-quarters of the electorate, not when they all have machetes. Political expediency, which Haitian politicians surely are as much entitled to take into consideration as the politicians of any other country, also require of a president of Haiti an avowed belief in black supremacy. Duvalier has said the right things, but rather mildly, and he has thus far given no indication that he wishes or intends to do more than talk. So far as I have been able to ascertain, neither the few resident whites nor the still numerous mulattoes fear a massacre under Duvalier's regime, although a majority of both groups now opposes him for other reasons. It is quite true that Duvalier, by having himself re-elected, showed a little less respect for the Constitution of Haiti than President Kennedy and the Supreme Court have thus far openly shown for ours. But after all, there is a difference. Duvalier may well feel that the Constitution that he violated is his. He proclaimed it some months after he took office in 1957, and Haitians, long accustomed to having a constitution made obsolete by, quote, modern needs, unquote, every few years, take a very liberal attitude towards such documents. Easy come, easy go. Let's see. The only rational way to judge Duvalier is to compare him with his predecessors in executive office since 1820, or rather, to be more exact, with those who managed to stay in office a full year or more and thus had time to exhibit their capacities. Anyone who glances at the monotonous pages of Haitian history will grant without argument that it would be possible to compile a long list of executives who were certainly far worse than Duvalier. How many were better? This list will be headed by President Fabre Geffrard, G-E-F-F-R-A-R-D, Fabre Geffrard, who was not only intelligent, but, on the basis of all the evidence, a man of high principles. He was, beyond question, far superior to Duvalier in every way, and governed Haiti well, until suddenly, and by the usual procedure, in 1867. He won the 1,000-meter dash to the harbor and spent the rest of his life in Jamaica. It is only when we look for someone to put in second place that our difficulties begin. We could, I think, unhesitatingly agree on President Cincinnatus LeConte if he had been able to hold office for more than a year, but he was retired in 1912 by the simple expedient of dynamiting the whole of the presidential palace in which he had barricaded himself with his family and guards. And it would not be fair to count the presidents of Haiti who nominally held office and did the bidding of American advisors while the Marines kept order. All things considered, we may assign second place to President Estime, whom we have already mentioned, since we cannot fairly put on his record a plan which he had no chance to carry out and may not, in fact, have resolved upon. There is something to be said for two or even three other executives of Haiti, but when we reach this point, we must recognize that it would require nice discrimination and anxious debate to determine which, if any, should be given precedence over Duvalier on our honor roll. We have neither space nor inclination for long and involved discussions here. So pretty much Haitian leadership has been terrible, with maybe two or three exceptions. Papa Doc's troubles. There has been no significant change in the character of Duvalier. There has been no significant change in the character of Duvalier or his government since his inauguration in 1957. In Haiti, efforts to replace executives normally begin on the day of their inauguration and continue until one is successful. The present crisis, however, though augmented by such natural forces, is primarily the work of our State Department. One of the purposes served by our foreign aid is to make foreign governments dependent on the decrees of the State Department. A foreign country quickly becomes accustomed to the idea that it is the duty of American serfs to work for the comfort and pleasure of superior peoples, and even failure to increase the tribute paid from year to year will excite great moral indignation. Handouts from the American Treasury quickly dislocate the country's economy and are far more habit-forming than heroin or cocaine. When the drug is suddenly cut off, the addict screams in real pain. Washington, after pumping more than $100 million of your money into Haiti, supported Duvalier by providing approximately half of Haiti's annual budget. When this was suddenly cut off, the result was naturally a terrific economic shock. Duvalier found himself in real trouble. That this was planned was shown by the fact that our leading poison paper suddenly and simultaneously, in lockstep, erupted with fervid denunciations of the tyrant and fascist who was president of Haiti. So they were doing the same garbage they're doing today as I read you this. They're doing in Venezuela. They've been doing for a very, very long time. To be sure, they had occasionally made an unkind remark about him ever since he outlawed the communist, quote, Democratic Alliance soon after taking office. But when the State Department pushed the control button, the whole of our captive press sounded off more loudly than the sirens in London during a German air raid. It is quite clear that our masters in Washington have decided to destroy Duvalier, and of course they will succeed. A report from Haiti on the 20th of May estimates that the president, who went into office with the support of at least 80% of the mulatto minority, is now supported by no more than a third, and possibly only a fifth of that group. It was more difficult to measure the sentiments of the Negroes, since a large part of the population outside the town has no political interest, so long as it is not directly affected by a governmental act or itself suddenly inspired to action. But the report very tentatively suggested that about 55-60% of the Negroes in the territory were at least passive supporters of the president at that time. It was noted, however, that, as is usual in Haiti, the situation could change drastically in a few hours. The moment that it seems that Duvalier is losing control, he will lose it. And unless he is extraordinarily nimble, he will lose more than that. The eventual result is a foregone conclusion. Even if it were many times larger and more prosperous and were united in support of its present executive, Haiti could not indefinitely resist the enormous pressures that Washington will exert, if necessary. And final subtitle, The Reason. Duvalier's friends claim that he has steadfastly refused to cooperate with the communist conspiracy, and his public record lends very considerable support to that claim. His enemies allege that he has several communists in his government and knows it. There are grounds for suspecting one of the persons named in this connection, but nothing seems to be known about the others. My guess is that Duvalier is more intelligent than the American, quote-unquote, liberals, and knows that no one can do business, openly or secretly, with the communists and hope to survive. It is entirely possible, however, that when his situation becomes desperate, he, like almost all drowning men, may grasp at a straw. The question is not a very important one. July-August 1963 is when that appeared, so that was some writing in American Opinion about Haiti and its history. And that's where we'll end today. I've been Alex Linder. You can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com. Thanks for being with me, and I'll be back with you again soon, and we'll do more from Revelo Oliver's America's Decline, The Education of a Conservative.